This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Law of Innocence, written by Michael Connelly and read by Peter Giles.
To Dr. Michael Hallisey, the members of the Hartford Hospital Book Club, and all of those on the front lines, including Casey Rose Gajewski, RN, who have risked themselves for so many others. A murder case is like a tree, a tall tree, an oak tree. It has been carefully planted and cared for by the state, watered and trimmed when needed, examined for disease and parasites of any kind. Its root system is constantly monitored as it flourishes underground and clings tightly to the earth. No money is spared in guarding the tree. Its caretakers are granted immense powers to protect and serve it. The tree's branches eventually grow and spread wide in splendor. They provide deep shade for those who seek true justice. The branches spring from a thick and sturdy trunk. Direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, forensic science, motive, and opportunity. The tree must stand strong against the winds that challenge it. And that's where I come in. I'm the man with the axe. My job is to cut the tree down to the ground and burn its wood to ashes. Part 1. Twin Towers. Chapter 1. Monday, October 28th. It had been a good day for the defense. I had walked a man right out of the courtroom. I had turned a felony battery charge into a righteous case of self-defense in front of the jury. The so-called victim had a history of violence of his own that both prosecution and defense witnesses, including an ex-wife, were eager to describe on cross-examination. I delivered the knockout punch when I recalled him to the witness stand and led him down a path of questioning that put him over the edge. He lost his cool and threatened me, said he'd like to meet me out in the street where it would just be him and me. "Would you then claim I attacked you, like you have with the defendant in this case?" I asked. The prosecutor objected and the judge sustained, but that was all it took. The judge knew it. The prosecutor knew it. Everybody in the courtroom knew it. I notched the NG after less than half an hour of jury deliberation. It wasn't my quickest verdict ever, but it came close. Within the informal downtown defense bar, there is a sacred duty to celebrate a not guilty verdict the way a golfer celebrates a hole-in-one at the clubhouse. That is, drinks all around. My celebration took place at the Redwood on 2nd Street, just a few blocks from the Civic Center, where there were no fewer than 3 courthouses to draw celebrants from. The Redwood was no country club, but it was convenient. The party, meaning the open bar, started early and ended late, and when Moira, the heavily tattooed bartender who had been keeping the tab, handed me the damage, let's just say I put more on my credit card than I would ever see from the client I had just set free. I had parked in a lot on Broadway. I got behind the wheel, took a left out of the lot, and then another to put me back on 2nd Street. The traffic lights were with me, and I followed the street into the tunnel that went under Bunker Hill. I was halfway through when I saw the reflection of blue lights on the tunnel's exhaust-smoked green tiles. I checked the mirror and saw an LAPD cruiser behind me. I hit the blinker and pulled into the slow lane to let him pass, but the cruiser followed my lead into the same lane and came up 6 feet behind me. I got the picture then. I was being pulled over. I waited until I was out of the tunnel and took a right onto Figueroa. I pulled to a stop, killed the engine, and lowered the window. In the Lincoln's side view mirror, a uniformed officer was walking up to my door. I saw no one else in the patrol car behind him. The officer approaching me was working alone. "Can I see your license, car registration, and proof of insurance, sir?"
he asked. I turned to look at him. His name tag said Milton.
You sure can, Officer Milton, I said.
But can I ask why you pulled me over?
I know I wasn't speeding, and all the lights were green.
License, Milton said. Registration, insurance.
Well, I guess you'll eventually tell me. My license is in my pocket, inside my coat. The other stuff is in the glove box. Which do you want me to go for first?
Let's start with your license.
You got it.
As I pulled my wallet and worked the license out of one of its slots, I reviewed my situation and wondered if Milton had been watching the Redwood for lawyers exiting my party and possibly too tipsy to drive. There had been rumors about patrol cops doing that on nights when there was an NG celebration going on, and defense lawyers could be picked off for a variety of moving vehicle violations. I handed Milton my license and then went for the glove box. Soon enough, the officer had all he had asked for.
Now, are you going to tell me what this is about? I asked.
I know I didn't step out of the car, sir, Milton said.
Oh, come on, man. Really?
Please step out of the car.
Whatever.
I threw the door open, aggressively forcing Milton to take a step back, and got out.
Just so you know, I said, I spent the last 4 hours in the Redwood, but I didn't have a drop of alcohol. I haven't had a drink in more than 5 years.
Good for you. Please step to the back of your vehicle.
Make sure your car camera is on, because this is going to be embarrassing.
I walked past him to the back of the Lincoln and stepped into the lights of the patrol car behind it.
You want me to walk a line? I said. Count backward, touch my nose with my finger, what? I'm a lawyer. I know all the games, and this one is bullshit.
Milton followed me to the back of the car. He was tall and lean, white, with a high and tight haircut. I saw the Metro Division badge on his shoulder and 4 chevrons on his long sleeves. I knew they gave them out for 5 years of service each. He was a veteran Metro bullethead all the way.
You see why I stopped you, sir? He said. Your car has no plate.
I looked down at the rear bumper of the Lincoln. There was no license plate.
God damn it, I said. This is some kind of prank. We were celebrating. I won a case today and walked my client. The plate says I walk 'em, and one of those guys must have thought it was a joke to steal the plate.
I tried to think about who had left the Redwood before I did, and who would have thought this was a funny thing to do. Daly, Mills, Bernardo. It could have been anyone.
Check the trunk, Milton said. Maybe it's in there.
No, they would need a key to put it in the trunk, I said. I'm going to make a call, see if I can.
Sir, you're not making a call until we're finished here.
That's bullshit. I know the law. I'm not in custody. I can make a call. I paused there to see if Milton had any further challenge. I noticed the camera on his chest.
My phone's in the car, I said.
I started moving back to the open door.
Sir, stop right there, Milton said from behind me.
I turned around.
What?
He snapped on a flashlight and pointed the beam down at the ground behind the car.
Is that blood? He asked.
I stepped back and looked down at the cracked asphalt. The officer's light was centered on a blotch of liquid beneath the bumper of my car. It was dark maroon at the center and almost translucent at its edges.
I don't know, I said.
But whatever it is, it was already there.
Just as I said it, we saw another drop come down from the bumper and hit the asphalt.
Sir, open the trunk, please, Milton demanded as he put the flashlight into a belt holster. A variety of questions cascaded through my mind, starting with what was in the trunk and ending with whether Milton had probable cause to open it if I refused. Another drop of what I now assumed to be bodily fluid of some sort hit the asphalt.
Write me the ticket for the plate, Officer Milton, I said, but I am not opening the trunk.
Sir, then I am placing you under arrest, Milton said. Put your hands on the trunk.
Arrest? For what? I'm not... Milton moved in on me, grabbing me, and spinning me toward my car. He threw all of his weight into me and doubled me over the trunk. Hey, you can't...
One at a time, my arms were roughly pulled behind my back, and I was handcuffed. Milton then put his hand into the back collar of my shirt and jacket and yanked me up off the car.
You're under arrest, he said.
For what? I said. You can't just...
For your safety and mine, I'm putting you into the back of the patrol car.
He grabbed my elbow to turn me again and walked me to the rear passenger door of his car. He put his hand on top of my head as he pushed me into the plastic seat in the back. He then leaned across to buckle me in.
You know you can't open the trunk, I said. You have no probable cause. You don't know if that's blood, and you don't know if it's coming from the interior of the car. I could have driven through whatever it is.
Milton pulled back out of the car and looked down at me.
Exigent circumstances, he said. There might be someone in there who needs help.
He slammed the door. I watched him go back to my Lincoln and study the trunk lid for some sort of release mechanism. Finding none, he went to open the driver's door and reached in to remove the keys. He used the key fob to pop the trunk, standing off to the side should someone come out of the trunk shooting. The lid went up, and an interior light went on. Milton supplemented it with his own flashlight. He moved from left to right, stepping sideways and keeping his eyes and the beam on the contents of the trunk. From my angle in the back of the patrol car, I could not see into the trunk, but could tell by the way Milton was maneuvering and bending down for a closer look that there was something there. Milton tilted his head to talk into the radio mic on his shoulder and then made a call, probably for backup, probably for a homicide unit. I didn't have to see into the trunk to know that Milton had found a body. Chapter 2. Sunday, December 1st. Edgar Quesada sat next to me at a dayroom table as I read the last pages of the transcript from his trial. He had asked me to review his case files as a favor, hoping there was something I could see or do to help his situation. We were in the high-power module in the Twin Towers Correctional Facility in downtown Los Angeles. This was where they housed inmates on keep-away status as they waited for trial or, as in Quesada's case, sentencing to state prison. It was the first Sunday evening in December, and the jail was cold. Quesada wore white long johns under his blue jumpsuit, the sleeves all the way down to his wrists. Quesada was in familiar surroundings. He had been down this path before and had the tattoos to prove it. He was a third-generation white fence gang member from Boyle Heights, with lots of inked allegiance to the gang and the Mexican Mafia, which was the largest and most powerful gang in California's jail and prison systems. According to the documents I had been reading, Quesada had been the driver of a car that carried two other members of White Fence as they fired automatic weapons through the plate glass windows of a bodega on East 1st Street, where the owner had fallen 2 weeks behind on the gang tax that White Fence had been extorting from him for almost 25 years. The shooters had aimed high, the attack intended to be a warning, but a ricochet went low and hit the bodega owner's granddaughter on the top of the head as she crouched behind the counter. Her name was Marisol Serrano. She died instantly, according to testimony I read from the deputy coroner. No witnesses to the crime identified the shooters. That would have been a fatal exercise in bravery. But a traffic cam caught the license plate on the getaway car. It was traced to a car stolen from the long-term parking garage at nearby Union Station, and cameras there caught a glimpse of the thief, Edgar Quesada. His trial lasted only 4 days, and he was convicted of conspiracy to commit murder. His sentencing was in a week, and he was looking at a minimum of 15 years in prison, with the likelihood of many more beyond that. All because he had been behind the wheel on a drive-by, warning-turned-murder. So,
Quesada said, as I flipped the last page over. Well, Edgar, I said, I think you're kind of fucked.
Man, don't tell me that. There's nothing, nothing at all?
There's always things you can do, but they're long shots, Edgar. I'd say you have more than enough here for an IAC motion, but
what's that?
Ineffective assistance of counsel. Your lawyer sat on his hands the whole trial. He let objection after objection pass. He just let the prosecutor... Well, here, you see this page? I moved back through the transcript to a page where I had folded a corner over. Here the judge even says, "Are you going to object, Mr. Seguin, or do I have to keep doing it for you?" That is not good trial work, Edgar, and you might have a shot at proving that. But here's the thing. At best, you win the motion and get a do-over, but that doesn't change the evidence. It's still the same evidence, and with the next jury, you'll go down again, even if you have a new lawyer who knows how to keep the prosecutor inside the lines. Quesada shook his head. He was not my client, so I didn't know all the details of his life, but he was about 35 and looking at a lot of hard time. How many convictions do you have? I asked.
Two, he said.
Felonies?
He nodded, and I didn't have to say anything else.
My original assessment stood. He was fucked. He was probably going away forever. Unless... You know why they got you here in high power instead of the gang module, right? I said. Any day now, they're going to pull you out of here, put you in a room, and ask you the big question. Who was in the car with you that day? I gestured to the thick transcript. There's nothing here that will help you, I said. The only thing you can do is deal the time down by giving up names. I said the last part in a whisper, but Quesada didn't respond as quietly.
That's bullshit, he yelled.
I checked the mirrored window of the control room overhead, even though I knew I could see nothing behind it. I then looked at Quesada and saw the veins in his neck start to pulse, even beneath the inked necklace of cemetery stones that circled it.
Cool down, Edgar, I said. You asked me to look at your file, and that's all I'm doing. I'm not your lawyer. You should really talk to him about...
I can't go to him, Quesada said.
Holler, you don't know shit!
I stared at him, and finally understood. His lawyer was controlled by the very people he would need to inform on. White Fence. Going to him would almost assuredly result in a Mexican mafia-engineered snitch shanking, whether he was in the high-power module or not. It was said that the MA, as it was more informally known, could get to anybody, anywhere, in a California lockdown. I was literally saved by the bell. The 5-minute warning horn before bed check sounded. Quesada reached across the table and roughly grabbed up his documents. He was through with me. He got up while still smoothing all the loose pages into a neat stack. Without a thank you or a fuck you, he headed off to his cell. And I headed to mine. Chapter 3. At 8 p.m., the steel door of my cell automatically slid closed with a metallic bang that jolted my entire being. Every night, it went through me like a train. I had been in lockup for 5 weeks now, and it was something I couldn't and didn't ever want to get used to. I sat down on the 3-inch thin mattress and closed my eyes. I knew the overhead light would stay on another hour, and I needed to use that time, but this was my ritual, to try to blank out all the harsh sounds and fears, to remind myself of who I still was, a father, a lawyer, but not a murderer.
You got Q all hot and bothered out there.
I opened my eyes. It was Bishop in the next cell. There was a grated air vent high up on the wall that separated our cells.
Didn't mean to, I said. I guess next time somebody needs a jailhouse lawyer in here, I'll just pass.
Good plan, Bishop said. And where were you, by the way, It was about to become kill the messenger time with him. I looked around. No bishop.
Don't worry, Holmes. I had you covered. I was watching from up on the rail. I had your back.
I was paying Bishop $400 a week for protection. The payment delivered in cash to his girlfriend and mother of his son in Inglewood. His protection extended throughout the quarter of the high-power octagon where we were housed. Two tiers, 24 single cells, with 22 other inmates presenting varying levels of known and unknown threat to me. On my first night, Bishop had offered to protect me or hurt me. I didn't negotiate. He usually stuck close when I was in the day room, but I had not seen him on the second-tier walkway rail when I gave Quesada the bad news about his case. I knew very little about Bishop because he didn't ask questions in jail. His dark black skin hid tattoos to the point of making me wonder why he even got them. But I'd been able to make out the words Crip Life inked across the knuckles of both his hands. I reached under the bed for the cardboard file box that held my own case docs. I checked the rubber bands first. I had wrapped each of the four stacks of documents with two bands each, horizontal and vertical, with the bands crossing at distinct spots on the top sheet. This told me if Bishop or anyone else had snuck in and gone through my stuff. I had a client once who almost went down on a first-degree murder because a jailhouse snitch had gotten to the files in his cell and read enough discovery material to concoct a convincing but phony confession he claimed my client had made to him. Lesson learned. I set rubber band traps and would know if someone had looked through my paperwork. I was now facing a first-degree murder charge myself and was going pro se, defending myself. I knew what Lincoln said, and probably many wise men before him and since. Maybe I did have a fool for a client, but I couldn't see putting my future in any hands other than my own. So in the matter of the state of California versus J. Michael Haller, the defense's war room was cell 13, level K-10, at Twin Towers Correctional Facility. I pulled my motions packet out of the box and snapped off the rubber bands after confirming that the documents had not been tampered with. A motions hearing was scheduled for the following morning, and I wanted to prep. I had three requests before the court, beginning with a motion to lower bail. It had been set at my arraignment at $5 million, with the prosecution successfully arguing that I was not only a flight risk, but a threat to witnesses in the case, because I knew the inner workings of the local justice system like the back of my hand. It didn't help that the judge handling the arraignment was the Honorable Richard Rollins Hagan, whose rulings in prior cases I had twice gotten overturned on appeal. He got some payback on me, agreeing with the prosecution's request to more than double down on the schedule that recommended a $2 million bail for first-degree murder. At the time, the difference between $2 million and $5 million didn't matter. I had to decide if I wanted to put everything I had into my freedom or into my defense. I decided on the latter and took up residence in Twin Towers, qualifying for keep-away status as an officer of the court who had potential enemies in all of the Gen Pop dorms. But tomorrow, I would stand before a different judge, one I believed I had never crossed, and ask for a reduction in bail. I had two other motions as well, and now reviewed my notes so I could stand and argue before the judge instead of read. More important than the bail motion was the discovery motion that accused the prosecution of withholding information and evidence I was entitled to, and the challenge to the probable cause of the police stop that led to my arrest. I had to assume that Judge Violet Warfield, who had drawn the case on rotation, would put a time cap on arguments on all the motions. I would need to be ready, succinct, and on point. "Hey, Bishop," I said, "you still awake?" "I'm awake," Bishop said. "What's up?" "I want to practice on you."
"Practice what?"
"My arguments, Bishop."
"That ain't part of our deal, man.
I know, but the lights are about to go out, and I'm not ready. I want you to listen and tell me what you think.
At that moment, the lights on the tier went out.
Okay, Bishop said. Let's hear it. But you pay extra for this.
Chapter 4. Monday, December 2nd. In the morning, I was on the first bus to the courthouse, having dined on a bologna sandwich and a bruised red apple for breakfast. It was the same breakfast every morning, and it was served again at lunch for good measure. In my 5 weeks here, we caught a break from it on Thanksgiving only, when the bologna was replaced with a slice of pressed turkey and served at all three meals. I was long past any revulsion with the food at Twin Towers. It was the routine, and now I put it away quickly and easily, every breakfast and every lunch. Still, I estimated that I had already lost between 10 and 20 pounds during my incarceration, and I looked at it as getting down to fighting weight for what would surely be the bout of my life. On the bus, I was with 39 other inmates, most of whom were heading to morning arraignment court. As a lawyer, I had seen the wide-eyed look of fear in clients when I met them for initial consultation at first appearances. But that was always in court, and always with me calming and preparing them for what lay ahead. On the buses, I was surrounded by it. Men facing their first experience of incarceration. Men who had been in lockup many times before. Rookie or recidivist, there was a palpable sense of desperation coming from all of them. I found the bus rides to and from court to be my own moments of biggest fear. It was random selection when you were loaded on. I had no bishop, no bodyguard. Should anything happen to me, the deputies were behind an iron grate at the front, the driver and so-called safety deputy. Their role would be simply to sort out the dead and dying when whatever happened was over. They weren't there to protect and serve, just to move people along in the underbelly of the justice system. This time, it was one of the modern buses with compartmentalized seating, the sight of which filled me with even more dread. The newer fleet was designed after there had been full-scale riots on buses that had raged out of control. With the sheriff's department responsible for the safety of inmates, the riots resulted in scores of lawsuits against the agency for failure to report those who had been injured and killed. I had lodged a couple of those lawsuits myself, and so was aware of the weaknesses of the old and new designs. The new buses were sectioned off by steel fencing into seating compartments of 8 inmates each. This way, if a fight broke out, it was contained to a maximum of 8 combatants. The buses had 5 such compartments and were loaded back to front, filling the seats in the rear section first, and so on. The prisoners were cuffed together, 4 to a chain, with one group on either side of the aisle in each compartment. This design was also the blueprint for a significant problem. Should the bus be in transit and a fight break out in the rear compartment, the unarmed safety deputy must unlock and move through 5 doors and 4 compartments, 4 tight spaces filled with inmates accused in some cases of violent crimes, to break up a fight in the 5th. The idea was preposterous, and to my thinking, the department's solution had actually doubled down on the problem. Fights in the rear compartments were allowed to play out until the bus got to its destination. Those who could walk off did, and those who couldn't were tended to. The bus pulled into the cavernous garage beneath the Clara Shortridge Foltz Criminal Justice Center, and we were offloaded and escorted into the building's vertical maze of holding cells that served its 24 different courtrooms. As a pro se, I was entitled to some legal niceties not afforded most of the men and women who came off the buses. I was led to a private holding cell where I could confer with my investigator and stand-in attorney
the lawyer assigned as my backup to handle the printing, filing, and in some cases fine-tuning of motions and other documents produced as part of the case. My investigator was Dennis Cisco Wojciechowski, and the stand-in was my law partner, Jennifer Aronson. Everything moves slowly in incarceration. My 4 a.m. wake-up at Twin Towers resulted in me getting to my private conference room at 8:40 a.m., a total travel distance of 4 blocks. I had brought 1 rubber-banded stack of documents with me, the motions, and was spreading them out on the metal table when my team was shown in by a detention deputy at 9 sharp. Cisco and Jennifer were required to sit across the table from me. No handshakes or hugs. The meeting fell under attorney-client privilege and was private. But there was a camera in one corner of the ceiling. We would be watched, but the camera carried no audio back to the deputy who monitored it. Or so it was claimed. I didn't fully believe this, and during prior team meetings, I had occasionally made a remark or issued an order designed to send the prosecution off on a wild goose chase if they happened to be illegally listening in. I used the code word Baja in each statement to alert my team to the ruse. I was in dark blue scrubs with LAC detention stenciled across the front and back of my shirt. Like Edgar Quesada the evening before, I wore long johns underneath. I had quickly learned during my stay with the county that the early morning bus rides and courthouse holding cells were unheated, and I dressed accordingly. Jennifer was dressed for court in a charcoal gray suit and cream-colored blouse. Cisco, as was his routine, was dressed for a sunset ride down the Pacific Coast Highway on his classic Harley Panhead, Cody Jinks blasting on his helmet stereo, black jeans, boots, and t-shirt. It appeared that his skin was impervious to the cold, damp air of the conference cell. That he was originally from Wisconsin might have had something to do with that. "How's my team this fine morning?" I said cheerily. Although I was the one incarcerated and wearing the jailhouse scrubs, I knew it was important to keep my people engaged and not worried about my predicament. "Act like a winner and you'll become a winner," as David Legal Siegel, my father's partner and the man who mentored me in the law, used to say. "All good, boss," Cisco said. "How are you doing?" Jennifer asked. "Better to be in the courthouse than the jail," I said. "Which suit did Lorna pick out?" Lorna Taylor was my case manager, as well as my sartorial consultant. This second duty extended from when she was my wife, my second wife, in a union that lasted only a year and preceded her marriage to Cisco. Though I would not be appearing this day before a jury, I had previously secured Judge Warfield's approval of a motion allowing me to dress in my professional clothes during all appearances in open court. My case had drawn considerable attention from the media, and I didn't want a photo of me in convict garb going viral. The world outside the courtroom was a jury pool from which 12 people would be drawn to judge me. I didn't want them, whoever they were, to have already seen me in jailhouse blues. My carefully curated selection of European suits also added to my confidence when I stood before the court to argue my case. "The blue Hugo Boss with pink shirt and gray tie," Jennifer said. "The courtroom deputy has it." "Perfect," I said. Cisco rolled his eyes at my vanity. I ignored it. "What about the time?" I asked. "You talked to the clerk?" "Yes, the judge slotted an hour," Jennifer said. "Will that be enough?" "Probably not, with argument from Dana. I might have to drop something if Warfield sticks to the schedule." Dana was Dana Berg, the Major Crimes Unit star prosecutor assigned to convicting me and sending me off to prison for the rest of my life. Among members of the downtown defense bar, she was known as Death Row Dana because of her propensity to seek maximum penalties or, alternately, as Iceberg, because of her demeanor when it came to negotiating pleas. The fact was that her resolve couldn't be melted, and she was most often assigned cases where trial was inevitable. And that was the situation with me. The day after my arrest, I had put out a media statement through Jennifer that forcefully denied the allegations against me and promised vindication at trial. It was most likely that statement that got the case assigned to Dana Berg.
"Then what do we drop?" Jennifer asked.
"Let's put bail on the back burner," I said.
"Wait, no," Sisko said.
"What? I wanted to go with that right out of the gate," Jennifer said. "We need you to get out of there and into unrestricted strategy sessions in an office, not a cell."
Jennifer raised her hands to take in the space where we were sitting. I knew that they would both protest my decision on bail, but I intended to make better use of today's time in front of the judge. "Look, it's not like I'm having a great time at Twin Towers," I said. "It's not the Ritz, but there are things that are more important to accomplish today. I want to get a full hearing on the probable cause challenge. That's number one. And then I want to argue the discovery issues. You ready on that, Bullocks?" It had been a long time since I had called Jennifer by her baby lawyer nickname. I had hired her right out of Southwestern Law School, which was housed in a former Bullocks department store. I had wanted somebody with a working-class law degree and an underdog's drive and fierceness. In the years since, she had proved me a genius, rising from associate counsel to whom I handed off low-money cases to full partner and trusted confidant who could hold her own and win in any courtroom in the county. I wasn't interested in using her as a mere filer of documents. I wanted her going toe-to-toe with Dana Berg on the prosecution's delays in discovery. This was the most important case of my career, and I wanted her side by side with me at the defense table.
"I'm ready," she said, "but I'm also ready to argue bail. You need to be out so you can prepare for trial without needing a bodyguard watching your back while you're eating bologna fucking sandwiches."
I laughed. I guessed I had complained a little too often about the Twin Towers menu. "Look, I get that," I said, "and I don't mean to laugh. But I need to keep payroll going, and I just don't want to come out of this thing bankrupt and with nothing left for my daughter. Somebody's got to pay for law school, and it's not going to be Maggie McPherce." My first ex-wife and the mother of my child was a prosecutor in the district attorney's office. Real name, Maggie McPherson. She made a comfortable living and had raised our daughter Haley in a safe neighborhood in Sherman Oaks, not counting a 2-year stint in Ventura County, where she went to work for the DA while waiting for a political fire to burn itself out down here. I had paid for private schools all the way, and now Haley was 1L at USC after graduating from Chapman in May. That carried a steep price tag that fell solely to me to pay. I had planned for it and had covered it in savings, but not if I pulled the cash and put it into a non-refundable bond just to spring myself loose to prep for trial. I had done the math, and it wasn't worth it. Even if we persuaded Judge Warfield to cut bail in half, I was still looking at needing $250,000 to buy a bond that really only amounted to 3 months of freedom. After all, I had refused to waive my right to a speedy trial and had the state on a clock, 60 court days within which to put me on trial. This meant that the trial was only 2 months away in February, and the verdict would either give me back my freedom or permanently suspend it. On many previous occasions, I had counseled clients to save their bond money and nut it out in Twin Towers. Usually that was to make sure they had money to pay me, but now that was the counsel I gave myself.
"Have you talked to Maggie about this?" Jennifer asked. "Has she even visited you over there yet?"
"Yes, she's visited, and yes, we've talked," I said. "She says the same thing you say, and I don't disagree it would be better. But it's about priorities, case priorities.
Look, you know that Lorna, Cisco, and I have all said we can defer paychecks till this is over. I really think this is a case priority, and you need to reconsider. Besides, what about Haley? You already missed Thanksgiving with her. You want to miss Christmas, too?
Okay, duly noted. Let's see if there's time to get to it today. If not, we'll take it up in the next round. Let's move on past the motions. Cisco, what's happening with the review of previous cases?
Me and Lorna are through more than half the files, Cisco said. So far, nothing stands out, but we're working on it and making a list of possibles.
He was talking about a list of former clients and enemies who might have the motive and wherewithal to pin a murder rap on me.
Okay, I need that, I said. I can't just go into court and say I was framed. A third-party culpability case requires a third party.
We're on it, Cisco said. If it's there, we'll find it.
If? I asked.
I didn't mean it like that, boss, Cisco said. I just meant...
Listen, I said. I've spent the past 25 years of my life telling clients that it didn't matter to me whether they did it because my job was to defend them, not judge them. Guilty or innocent, you get the same deal and the same effort. But now that I'm on the other side of it, I know that's bullshit. I need you two, and Lorna, to believe in me on this.
Of course we do, Jennifer said.
Goes without saying, Cisco added.
Don't be so quick to answer, I said.
You must have questions about it. The state's case is more than persuasive. So if at any point Death Row Dana turns you into a believer, I need you to step up and step out. I don't want you on the team.
Not going to happen, Cisco said.
Never, added Jennifer.
Good, I said. Then let's go to war.
Jennifer, can you go get my suit and bring it in so I can get ready?
Be right back, she said.
She got up and hammered on the steel door with one hand while waving to the overhead camera with the other. Soon I heard the sharp metal crack of the door unlocking. A deputy opened it to let her out.
So, I said, once Cisco and I were alone, what's the water temp these days down in Baja?
Oh, it's nice, Cisco said. I talked to my guy down there, and he said high 80s.
Too warm for me. Tell him to let me know when it gets down to about 70. That would be perfect for me.
I'll tell him.
I nodded to Cisco and tried not to smile for the overhead camera. Hopefully, this last bit of conversation was intriguing enough to any illegal listeners to send them fishing for a red herring down in Mexico.
So, what about our victim? I said.
Still working on it, Cisco said hesitantly. I'm hoping Jennifer gets more stuff in Discovery today, so I can run down his movements and how and when he ended up in your trunk.
Sam Scales was a slippery guy. Nailing him down is going to be tough, but I'm going to need that.
Don't worry, you'll have it.
I nodded. I liked Cisco's confidence. I hoped it would pay off. I thought for a moment about my former client, Sam Scales, the ultimate con man, who had even conned me. Now, the victim in the biggest con of all, I was set up for a murder that I knew was going to be a hard frame to break.
Hey, boss, you okay? Cisco asked.
Yeah, fine, I said. Just thinking about things. This is going to be fun.
Cisco nodded. He knew it was going to be anything but fun, but he understood the sentiment. Act like a winner, and you'll become a winner. The cell door slid open again, and Jennifer came back in, carrying my court clothes on two hangers. I usually reserved the pink Oxford for appearances before a jury, but that was okay. Just seeing the sharp cut of the suit kicked my mood up to a new level. I started getting ready for battle.
Chapter 5. My suit fit me loosely. I felt like I was swimming in it.
The first thing I told Jennifer when they moved me into court and took off the chains was to ask Lorna to go to my house, pick out two of my suits, and take them to the tailor to be altered.
"That's going to be kind of hard without you there to be measured," she said.
"I don't care. It's important," I said. "I don't want to look like a guy in a borrowed suit in front of the media. That gets out to the jury pool and sends a message."
"Okay, I get it."
"Tell her to have them taken in a full size all around." Before she could respond, Dana Berg stepped over to the defense table and put down a set of documents.
"Our answers to your motions," she said. "I'm sure it will all come out in oral."
"Timely," Jennifer said, meaning it was anything but.
She started reading. I didn't bother. Berg seemed to hesitate, as if expecting a retort from me. I just looked up and smiled.
"Good morning, Dana," I said. "How was your weekend?"
"Better than yours, I'm sure," she said.
"I think that would be a given," I said. She smirked and returned to the prosecution table.
"No surprise, she's objecting to everything," Jennifer said, "including bail reduction."
"Par for the course," I said. "Like I said, don't worry about bail today. We'll—" I was silenced by the booming voice of Morris Chan, the courtroom deputy, announcing the arrival of Judge Warfield. We were instructed to remain seated and come to order. I believed I got lucky when we drew Warfield on the case. She was a tough law and order jurist, but she was also a former member of the defense bar. Oftentimes, defense lawyers who become judges seem to go out of their way to show impartiality by favoring the prosecution. That was not what I had heard about Warfield. While I had never had a case before her, I had listened to the conversations of some of the other defense pros at the Redwood and Four Green Fields in the past, and the picture I got was of a judge who threw her pitches right down the middle. In addition, she was African-American, and that made her an underdog. Coming up, she had to be better than the other lawyers. That demanded a mindset I liked. She knew full well the disadvantages I faced in trying to defend myself. My guess was that she would include that knowledge in her decisions.
"We're on the record in California versus Haller, and we have a series of defense motions to consider," the judge said. "Mr. Haller, will you be offering argument, or will it be your co-counsel, Ms. Aronson?"
I stood to reply. "May it please the court," I began. "We would like to tag team a little bit today. I would like to start with a motion to suppress."
"Very well," Warfield said. "Proceed."
Here's where it got tricky. I had filed what was technically a motion in limine to exclude evidence that had been unconstitutionally obtained. I was challenging the traffic stop that led to the discovery of the body of Sam Scales in the trunk of my car. If I won the motion, the case against me would probably be DOA. But it was a long shot to believe that a judge, even as impartial as I had heard Warfield to be, would throw such a wrench into the state's case. But that was what I was counting on, because I didn't want that to happen either. With any other client, I would want that ruling. But this was my own case. I did not want to win on a technicality. I needed to be exonerated. The trick here was to have a full-blown hearing on the constitutionality of the traffic stop that put me in jail. But I only wanted it in order to get Officer Milton on the stand so that I could draw out his story and lock it down under oath. Because I believed I was set up, and that the setup had to have included Milton in some way, whether knowingly or not. Carrying the printout of the motion, I walked to the lectern between the prosecution and defense tables. On the way, I casually checked the gallery and saw at least two people I recognized as journalists covering the hearing. They were the conduit I would use to get my defense out into the world. I also saw my daughter, Haley, in the back row. I assumed she was cutting class at USC Law, but I couldn't be too upset. I had forbidden her to visit me in jail.
I didn't want her ever to see me in jail scrubs, and had gone so far as to leave her off my approved visitors list. So court was where she could see and support me, and that was not lost on me. I also knew that she was leaving the make-believe world of law school and getting a real education in the law by being here. I threw her a nod and a smile, but seeing her now reminded me how ill-fitting my suit was. It looked borrowed and announced that I was a convict to all courtroom observers. I might as well have been wearing the scrubs. I tried to shake off these thoughts when I got to the lectern, and I turned my attention to the judge. "Your Honor," I said, "as the motion before the court states, the defense contends that I was set up and framed in this case, and that setup came into play with the illegal and unconstitutional stop by the police on the night I was arrested. I have re- Set up by whom, Mr. Haller?" the judge asked. I was thrown by the question. As valid as it might have been, it was unexpected from the judge, especially before I finished my argument. "Judge, that is irrelevant to this hearing," I said. "This is about the traffic stop and whether it was constitutional. But you are saying you were framed. Do you know who framed you?" "Again, Your Honor, that is irrelevant. In February, it will be very relevant when we go to trial, but I don't see why I have to reveal my case to the prosecution while challenging the validity of the traffic stop."
"Then continue."
"Thank you, Your Honor, I will. Is that a shot?"
"Excuse me?"
"What you just said, is that a shot at me, Mr. Haller?" I shook my head, confused. I couldn't even remember what I had said.
No, not a shot, Judge," I said. "I don't remember what I said, but it was in no way intended to..."
"Very well, let's move on," the judge said. I remained confused. The judge appeared to be sensitive to anything she construed as a questioning of her skill or authority, but it was good to register this early in the process.
"Okay, well, I apologize if anything I said sounded disrespectful," I said. "As I was saying, I've filed a motion to suppress, challenging the probable cause to stop and the probable cause supporting a warrantless search of the trunk of the vehicle I was driving. An evidentiary hearing is required on the issues raised, with the attendance of the officer who stopped me and searched my vehicle. I would like to schedule a time for that hearing, but before we can do that, I have other matters that need to be addressed. My investigator has been trying for 5 weeks, Your Honor, to talk to the officer who stopped me, Officer Roy Milton, and has been unsuccessful despite numerous requests to him and the police department. I know we will be discussing our discovery motion later, but same thing, no cooperation from the DA's office in regard to the arrest. This is a continuation of the prosecution's effort since day one to prevent a fair trial from occurring." Berg stood up, but Warfield held up a hand to prevent her from speaking.
"Let me stop you right there, Mr. Haller," the judge said. "That is a very serious accusation you just made. You'd better back that up right now."
I composed my thoughts before proceeding. "Your Honor," I finally began, "the prosecution clearly does not want me to question Officer Milton, and you can see this all the way back in the decision to go to a grand jury for an indictment and have him testify in secret instead of holding a preliminary hearing where I would be able to question him. In the California courts, a felony charge can advance to trial only after a preliminary hearing in which evidence of probable cause for the arrest is presented to a judge and the defendant is ordered to trial. An alternative to the preliminary hearing is for the prosecution to present the case to a grand jury and ask for an indictment on the charge. That was what Berg had done in this case. The difference between the two procedures is that a preliminary hearing is held in open court, where the defense is allowed to question
any witness who testifies in front of the judge, while a grand jury operates in secret. The grand jury is a perfectly valid option for the prosecution to choose, Warfield said. And it prevents me from questioning my accusers, I said. Officer Milton was clearly wearing a body camera the night of my arrest, in keeping with LAPD regulations, and we have not been given that video. I also noted that there was a video camera in the police car, and we have not been given that video either. Your Honor, Dana Berg said, the state objects to defense's argument. He is turning a motion to suppress evidence in the case into a request for evidence. I'm confused.
So am I, Warfield said.
Mr. Holler, I allowed you to defend yourself because you are an experienced lawyer, but you are sounding more and more like an amateur. Please stay on point.
Well then, I too am confused, Your Honor, I said. I filed a legally sufficient motion to suppress the fruits of a warrantless search. Ms. Berg bears the burden of demonstrating the justification for the search, yet I don't see Officer Milton in the courtroom. So unless the prosecution is about to announce a concession, Ms. Berg is not ready to defend against the motion. Yet Ms. Berg acts as though she is outraged, and as though I'm supposed to merely argue and be done with it.
Judge, the point is, I request an evidentiary hearing and an opportunity to prepare for that hearing after receiving the discovery I am entitled to. I can't properly and fully argue the motion to suppress because the prosecution is violating the rules of discovery. I ask the court to table this for today, order the prosecution to fulfill its discovery obligations, and schedule a full evidentiary hearing on the motion at a time when witnesses, including Officer Milton, may appear. The judge looked at Berg.
I know we have a discovery motion in Mr. Holler's stack, Warfield said, but where are we on those items just mentioned? The video from the officer and the car. Those should have been turned over by now.
Judge, Berg said, we had technical issues with the transfer of...
Your Honor, I roared. They can't be pulling this technical difficulty excuse. I was arrested 5 weeks ago today. My freedom is on the line here. And for them to say technical issues have delayed my due process rights is patently unfair. They are trying to keep me from getting to Milton, plain and simple. They did it when they went to a grand jury instead of a prelim, and they are doing it again here. I have not waived my right to a speedy trial, and the prosecution is doing anything and everything it can to push me toward a delay.
Ms. Berg, Warfield said, response to that?
Judge, Berg said, if the defendant would stop interrupting me before I even finish a sentence, he would have heard that we had, that's past tense, technical difficulties, but they were cleared up, and I have the videos from the officer's car and body cam to give to the defendant today. Additionally, the state objects to any suggestion that it is dragging its feet or pressuring the defendant in any way to delay this case. We are ready to go, Your Honor. We are not interested in a delay.
Very well, Warfield said. Turn the videos over to the defense, and we will...
Your Honor, point of order, I said.
What is it, Mr. Holler? The judge said. I'm losing my patience.
Counsel just referred to me as the defendant, I said. Yes, I am the accused in this case, but when I am arguing before the court, I am counsel for the defense, and I request that the court direct Ms. Berg to refer to me properly.
You are talking about semantics, Mr. Holler, Warfield said. The court sees no need for such direction to the prosecution. You are the defendant. You are also the defense counsel. Same difference in this case.
Members of a jury might see the difference, Your Honor, I said.
Warfield once again held her hand up like a traffic cop before Berg could voice an objection.
No argument from the people is needed, she said. The defense request is denied. We are going to continue this motion to Thursday morning. Ms. Berg, I will expect you to have Officer Milton here to be questioned about the traffic stop of Mr. Haller. I will be happy to sign a subpoena to that effect if needed. But rest assured that if he does not appear, I'll be inclined to grant the motion. Is that understood, Ms. Berg?
Yes, Your Honor, Berg said.
Very well. Let's move on to the next motion, Warfield said. I have to leave the courthouse at 11 for an outside meeting. Let's press on.
Your Honor, my co-counsel, Jennifer Aronson, will discuss the motion to compel discovery.
Jennifer got up and approached the lectern. I went back to the defense table, and we lightly touched arms as we passed each other.
Go get him, I whispered.
Chapter 6. The perks I received as a pro se inmate extended to the detention center, where I was afforded space and time for daily meetings with my legal team. I set these meetings Monday through Friday at 3 p.m., whether or not there were issues or strategy to discuss. I needed the connection to the outside, if only for the mental health maintenance. The meetings were a hardship for Cisco and Jennifer, because they and their belongings were searched coming in and going out, and the rule was that the team had to be in place in the attorney-client room before I was even pulled from the module where I was housed. Everything in the jail moved at an indifferent pace, set by the deputies running the show. The last thing afforded an inmate, even a pro se, was punctuality. It was the same reason my wake-ups were at 4 a.m., for a hearing 6 hours later and only 4 blocks away. These delays and harassments meant that they usually had to present themselves at the jail's attorney's entrance at 2 p.m., so that I might see them for an hour beginning at 3 p.m. The meeting that followed the court hearing was more important than a mental health hour. Judge Warfield had signed an order allowing Jennifer Aronson to bring a disc player into the jail for the legal team conference so that I could view the videos that had finally been turned over by the prosecution. I was late to the meeting because it had taken nearly 4 hours to bus me back from the courthouse to the jail. By the time they put me in the lawyer room, Jennifer and Cisco had been waiting nearly an hour. "Sorry, guys," I said, as I was ushered in by a deputy. "I don't control things around here."
"Yeah, no kidding," said Cisco.
It was the same setup as with the attorney room in the courthouse. They sat across from me. There was a camera that supposedly had no audio feed. The difference here was that I was allowed to use a pen when I was in the room to keep notes or handwrite motions to the court. I was not allowed to take a pen back to my cell because it could be used as a weapon, a pipe, or a source for tattoo ink. In fact, I was allowed a red ink pen only because it was considered an undesirable tattoo color should I somehow smuggle it back to my pod.
"Have you looked at the videos yet?" I asked.
"Only about 10 times while we were waiting," Cisco said.
"And?" I looked at Jennifer with a question. She was the lawyer.
"Your recall of what was said and done was excellent," she said.
"Good," I said. "Can you stand to watch it again? I want to take notes for the Q&A with Officer Milton."
"Do you think that's the best way to go?" Jennifer asked.
I looked at her.
"You mean me asking the guy who arrested me the questions?"
"Yes. Might look vindictive to the jury."
I nodded.
"It could, but there won't be a jury."
"There will probably be reporters. It will get out to the pool."
"Okay. I'm still going to write questions, and we'll make it a game time decision. You should write up what you would ask, and we'll compare tomorrow or Wednesday."
I was not allowed to touch the computer. Cisco turned the screen toward me. He played the video from Milton's body cam first. The camera was attached to his uniform at chest height. The footage began with a view of the steering wheel of his car and quickly moved to him exiting the car and moving up the shoulder of the road toward a car I recognized as my Lincoln.
"Stop it," I said. "This is bullshit."
Cisco hit the stop button.
"What is bullshit?" Jennifer asked.
"The video," I said. "Berg knows what I want, and she's fucking with us, even though she made the grand gesture of compliance in court today. I want you to go back to the judge tomorrow with a motion requesting the full video. I want to see where this guy was and what he was doing before I supposedly happened to cross his path. Tell the judge we want to go back half an hour minimum on the body cam, and we want the full video before we go in for the hearing Thursday."
"Got it."
"Okay, go ahead with what they gave us." Cisco hit the play button again, and I watched. There was a time code in the corner of the screen, and I immediately started writing down times and notes to go with them. The traffic stop and what happened afterward was pretty much how I remembered it. I saw several places where I thought I could score points, questioning Milton, and a few others where I thought I might be able to lead him into a lie trap. Where I saw new stuff on the video was when Milton opened the trunk of the Lincoln and looked down to examine Sam's scales for any sign of life. I had been in the back seat of Milton's patrol car at that point, my view of the trunk limited and from a low angle. Now, I was looking at Sam's body on its side, knees pulled up toward the chest and arms behind his back, secured with several wraps of duct tape. He was overweight and looked as though he was crammed into the trunk. I could see bullet wounds in the chest and shoulder areas, and what looked like an entrance wound on the left temple and an exit through the right eye. This wasn't new to me. We'd already gotten crime scene photos in the first batch of discovery from Berg, but the video lent a visceral realness to the crime and the crime scene. Sam Scales in life deserved no sympathy, but in death, he looked pitiful. Blood from his wounds had spread across the floor of the trunk and dripped out through a hole created by the bullet that exited his eye. "Oh, shit," Milton could be heard saying. And then he followed his exclamation with a low humming that sounded like a stifled laugh. "Play that part again," I said, "after Milton says, oh, shit." Cisco replayed the sequence, and I listened again to the sound Milton had made. It was almost like he was gloating. I thought it might be useful for a jury to hear. "Okay, freeze it," I said. The image on the screen froze. I looked at Sam Scales.